The Christian State of Life, or Sermons on the Principal Duties of Christians in General and of Different States in Particular, by Father Francis Hunault, translated from the original German edition of Cologne, 1740, by Father J. Allen. Copyright 1886. On the Unnecessary Troubles of Married People, preached on the third Sunday after Easter. You shall be made sorrowful. John 16:20. Introduction. The ordinary and, as I think, beautiful salutation among the ancient Greeks when meeting one another in the street was, "May you do well and be joyful." In our days, we have another form of greeting, such as, "Good morning, good evening, good day, a happy new year," or if one is going anywhere, "A pleasant journey," or if one wishes to pay compliments, he says, "Your servant, your most obedient," etc. And most frequently, these expressions are mere empty words and nothing more. Good Christians, when they meet, have now the praiseworthy custom of saying, "Praise be Jesus Christ," and would that it was always said with proper reverence, which is not always the case, so that some dishonor that most holy name instead of honoring it. Although I give the preference to this last salutation, yet I now address you after the manner of the Greeks, and wish, my dear brethren, that you may do well and be joyful. This is my heartfelt wish for you, especially married Christians, and I wish most earnestly that I could really cause you to feel this most desirable joy. But our Savior has said something else to all his elect who do good and try to live piously. You shall be made sorrowful. In the married state especially, as you well know, there are, now and then, reasons enough for sorrow. Either the marriage is unfortunate, so that you do not live peacefully together, and that is indeed a great cross, as you have heard already. Or if it is fortunate, so that you live in peace and love together, and that is great good luck indeed. Yet you often find things of trouble, some of which give you reasonable cause for sorrow, and therefore make you deserving of pity, and I will try to console you for them next Sunday. While you yourselves make crosses and troubles of others without any necessity, nay, sometimes, even when you should have rejoiced at them, this shall form the matter of today's sermon. Plan of discourse. Some married people trouble themselves without any reasonable cause. "Oh, do not do that," such will be the first part. Others trouble themselves when they should rather rejoice. "What a foolish proceeding," the second part. "Do well in the sight of God and be joyful in the Lord," will be the concluding wish. Which may the God of mercy effect in all through the merits of His Holy Mother Mary and the Holy Angels Guardian. Sadness is a pain and perturbation of mind on account of a suffering from which one wishes to be freed, or on account of an unsatisfied desire. St. John Damascene distinguishes four kinds of sadness. The first is when one is troubled at seeing or knowing of the sufferings and misfortune of another. Thus, the mother is troubled at the pain her child suffers, the friend on account of his friend's misfortune, and every kind-hearted man at the misery of his fellow man. This sadness is called compassion or pity. The second is when one is troubled at another's well-being, because, for instance, the other is richer, more learned, or happier. Such was the case with Joseph's brethren when they saw him more richly dressed than they were. This is envy. The third is when one is grieved at what he believes to be an injustice, or a thing that should not occur, although it may not concern him. Thus, many a one is grieved at a manifest wrong, or because another is instructed with a charge that he is not fitted for, and so on. This is called indignation. If this is caused by something contrary to the honor due to God, it is called pious zeal. The fourth kind of sadness is the grief that everyone feels in contradictions that afflict him so, and that trouble either the soul or the body. Thus the merchant is grieved at the losses he has suffered, or because he has not gained a lawsuit. An honorable man is grieved at an insult offered him. A husband is grieved at the death of his wife, the wife at the death of her husband, the parents at the illness or death of their children, etc. And this is what is properly called sadness. None of these four kinds is of any use when it is excessive or when it comes from an unreasonable cause, and it is one of the rarest arts in the world, as Plato says, to know how to be sad and how to be joyful at the proper time and in the proper degree. Oh, if all men, and especially married people, understood this art thoroughly and used it properly, how much chagrin and unnecessary trouble would be avoided. I must repeat what I have said before, that many things occur in the married state which give just cause for trouble and sadness, but it is true nevertheless that many people make their troubles greater than they ought to be, nay, they often trouble themselves without any reasonable cause. They seek troubles with a lantern, so to speak, and bring them into their houses, contrary to the warning of the wise Ecclesiasticus, give not up thy soul to sadness, and afflict not thyself in thy own counsel. I will not say anything of those who annoy themselves about things that do not at all concern them, like that malefactor who, while he was being led to the gallows, kept on grumbling and murmuring the whole way. And what was he grumbling about, my dear brethren? About having to die such a shameful death as anyone would imagine. That would indeed be a rational subject for discontent, but that did not trouble him. He was annoyed because the streets were not better kept and were allowed to be encumbered with all sorts of rubbish. Oh, foolish man, how do the streets concern you? Leave the care of them to other citizens, who must walk on them many times a day and often experience the inconvenience of them. What is it to you whether the streets are clean or dirty, well or ill kept, since you will never walk on them again? Any street is good enough to walk to the gallows on. In almost the same manner do many make troubles and annoyances for themselves and grumble at things that they have, so to say, picked up in the streets. Look, they say, what a grand house such a one has built, as if he wished to spite us and other decent people. See how finely that woman and her daughter are dressed, and what airs they put on, as if we did not know them. It is enough to make one cross. Could not we do the same if we chose? If I could not feel that life is better than such a one, I would not undertake it. He is only fit to annoy the people, etc. They trouble themselves with things of this kind, and sometimes to such an extent that they become quite unhappy and discontented. Why do you plague yourselves about such foolish things? I must ask you, as Christ said to Peter, who was troubled at the thought of what would become of his fellow apostle John. What is that to thee? Why do you trouble yourself with the concerns of others? Have you nothing to annoy you at home? If you have not, you ought to live in peace and be cheerful. Do not seek for troubles, especially in matters that do not concern you, and afflict not thyself in thy own counsel. Another source of trouble, common enough amongst married people, especially when they live together in harmony, is that they make crosses and trials for themselves in their own imaginations, where in reality none exist, or they make mountains out of molehills, thereby showing the truth of what Seneca says. We are often more troubled at fancied trials than at real ones, like horses that are afraid of their own shadow on the road. We have an example of this in the sacred scriptures, in the prophet Jonas. Behold him seated alone, full of sorrow and affliction. And Jonas was exceedingly troubled and was angry. Poor prophet, what is the matter with you that you weep and lament so? Here is what ailed him, my dear brethren. At the command of God, he had gone through the great city of Nineveh and foretold its destruction to its inhabitants in these words, "Yet 40 days and Nineveh shall be destroyed." But since the people, terrified at the prophecy, had done penance and repented of their sins, God was appeased, and recalling the sentence he had pronounced, resolved to spare the city. Jonas, meanwhile, was anxiously awaiting the 40th day, and that on which his prediction was to be fulfilled. He looked up to heaven and down to earth, hoping to see some sign that his prophecy was coming true, but in vain. The 40th day passed, and several more days also, and Nineveh was still untouched. That was what troubled Jonah so much. Filled with shame and hiding his face so that one might not recognize him, he slunk out of the city into a desert place and there commenced his lamentations. "What," he said, "am I a preacher and prophet to be thus put to shame? I have been told to announce an event that was sure to happen, and now the contrary takes place. Thus I am a false prophet. That is my reward. O Lord, I beseech thee, take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live, and to bear my grief and my shame together." "Ah, Jonas, Jonas," said God to him, "dost thou think thou hast reason to be angry? Is that the whole cause of thy trouble? What greater consolation could there be for a prophet and preacher than to see his hearers shed tears of repentance, amend their lives, and escape the punishment they were threatened with by God? You should rejoice at having done your work so well, but instead of rejoicing, you are troubled so much as to desire death. Dost thou think thou hast just cause for thy anger?" There is no doubt, my dear brethren, that Jonas had no reason for sorrow, but rather much reason for joy. His trouble came solely from his own imagination. He thought that the whole city would look upon him as a false prophet who had betrayed the people and made them fast and do penance for nothing, whereas the contrary was really the case. St. Ephrem represents the Ninevites as speaking thus, "Grieve not, O Jonas, but rejoice that we now lead a new life, that thy preaching has moved us to do penance, and thus turned aside from us the wrath of God. We look upon thee as our greatest benefactor, by whose warning we have received light and grace." Meanwhile, Jonas was in a despairing state. So great was his affliction that he wished for death to escape the shame that overwhelmed him when he thought that the whole city would consider him a false prophet. How many there are who might be asked the same question. Dost thou think thou hast reason to be angry? You, O husband, who give way to all sorts of fancies if your wife only turns her head aside, or if she fails to meet you in her usual friendly manner. Do you think that you have reason to be angry? You, O wife, if your husband, occupied with other cares, appears before you with a stern countenance, or gives you a short answer without meaning any harm, immediately think that his love is growing cold, or that he despises, neglects, or hates you. Then the two of you go about the whole day, gloomy and ill-tempered, not speaking a word to each other, and tormenting yourselves to such an extent that you can hardly sleep at night. And if the cause of all this trouble is sought for, it will be found to exist merely in the imagination. In the same way, they trouble themselves frequently at the bare idea and imagination of a trial that may come upon them. For instance, the husband is away from home, or the son is in a foreign country. If a letter does not come on the very day appointed, Then the wife at once begins to imagine that there is something wrong. Her husband has certainly met with some misfortune. Her son is very sick, or perhaps dead, or something else has happened to him. With such thoughts as these, they torture themselves day and night. They mourn as dead those who are living. They bewail the sickness of those who are strong and healthy, or the misfortune of those who are quite safe and prosperous. Until, at last, the news comes that they have been weeping and wailing for nothing. Meanwhile, they have been tormenting themselves for no other reason but what their own foolish fancies suggested. If they had waited a little longer until the good news came, they would have escaped all that suffering. And even if their worst fears were realized, it would have been time enough to give way to their affliction when they heard that there was reason for it. And so they would have avoided suffering the same sorrow twice over, or they would not have had it for such a long time. Do you think that you have just reason to trouble yourselves, you merry people, if one of you has a slight cold or an attack of fever, or if one of your children is thus afflicted? Yet what moaning and lamentations you make, excited thereto by your own gloomy fancies. If a child were to die, all my consolation in this world is gone. What would become of me if my husband died? What would become of my children? How could I support them? There would be no hope for me. I should despair. In that way they torment themselves for weeks and months, as long as the illness lasts. At the bare idea of trials that may come upon them in certain circumstances, but which perhaps will never come at all. In the name of God, what is the use of that? Wait until the trial has come upon you. Then it will be time enough for you to commence to trouble about it. There is nothing gained by doing so beforehand. Your children, your husband, or your wife will, in all probability, recover. So your long fretting is to no purpose. In the same way, generally speaking, they act when events occur which give them just cause for uneasiness, but they exaggerate things and make them worse than they are. For instance, the husband, the child, the friend is dead. That is, I must confess, a hard trial, but they make it harder. Oh, they say, if we had called in another doctor, if we had tried the medicine that a good friend recommended to us, perhaps he would now be alive and well. Yes, perhaps, and perhaps not. He is dead. What is the use of your perhaps? If they have used every means possible, they say, oh, what a pity that we plagued the poor man with so many medicines and so much bloodletting. It did him no good, and he would not have been so much troubled. Perhaps, even, it was the medicine or the bloodletting that caused his death. If that is the case, we are to blame. There you have another perhaps. No matter what they do, they are not satisfied. Why do you trouble yourselves about things of which you can know nothing? The man is dead. Weep for him, if you have cause to do so, but put those foolish notions out of your head. So true is it that they who have no one else to torment themselves. But what an unreasonable thing it is to make for ourselves trials that we always try to avoid. Afflict not thyself in thy own counsel. In these cases, the imagination must be kept in check, and you will avoid much affliction. Yes, you say, but how? That is a difficult thing to do. Where is the difficulty? When you look at the moon, you would be inclined to say that it is much larger than any of the stars in the firmament, although in reality, the smallest star is much greater in size than the moon. An ignorant person would not believe this, yet it is the firm conviction of everyone who knows anything of astronomy. If you are sailing down the Marseille in a boat and fix your eyes on the town of Treves, you would imagine, although you know better, that it is the town that is moving and not the boat. No matter how small the stars appear to you, you know that they are greater than the moon, because you have often heard so from those who understand the subject. How easily, then, you may correct with your understanding the error into which you are led by the imagination. In the same way, you should accustom yourselves, in the cases above mentioned and in similar ones, to keep the imagination in check, so as to preserve your cheerfulness and quiet. Think and say to yourself, I have tormented and plagued and worried myself so often during my life for a mere imaginary cause, and nearly always I have found that the contrary to what I dreaded really occurred. It is possible the same with me now. Therefore, I will not be so foolish as to trouble myself until I know for what. How often have I not thought that my neighbor or friend was deliberately insulting me, because he passed me by once without saluting, or because, on some occasion or other, he did not speak to me, or because he let fall a dubious expression here and there. How often have I not thought that my husband or my wife was cross with me on account of a mere unfriendly look, and yet there was no cause for all this apprehension, so that I annoyed myself to no purpose. This is just a similar case. How often have I feared that my husband, my wife, my child, or my friend had met with some mishap, or even with death itself, and behold, they are all alive and well, and so it will now be in this apparent danger, in this misfortune that I dread, it will all turn out well in the end. Therefore, I will wait patiently and quietly, and recommend the future to God. You see now how easy it is to avoid many crosses that you make for yourselves in your state of life. If you do not do so, you are not to be pitied, because you do not try to make things better. There are others who think they have cause for sorrow when they should really rejoice. This I will speak of in the second part. Children are the most fruitful cause of unnecessary trouble in the married state. Some people cannot be consoled because they have no children. Others, because they have too many. Others, again, because their children die young. Let us see now whether they have cause for sorrow, and not rather for joy and consolation. The first have no children, although they wish very much to have them. It is true that the principal end of the married state is to bring up children in the service of God, and to lead their souls to heaven, that they may praise God and bless Him for all eternity. It is true that children, when they are good, are the crown and joy of their parents, and therefore, in the old law, unfruitfulness was looked upon as a great misfortune, nay, even as a shame and disgrace. How afflicted Anna, the wife of Elkanah, was on account of her barrenness. She could not eat or drink. Her daily occupation was to weep and sigh because she had no children, so that at last her husband said to her, Anna, why weepest thou, and why dost thou not eat? As we read in the first book of Kings, first chapter. And Rachel, too, how troubled she was, so that, like Jonas, she longed for death. I must have children, she said to her husband, otherwise I shall die. Now, although sterility is to be attributed to natural causes, yet it certainly depends on the decrees of God's providence. And therefore the patriarch Jacob answered the complaints of Rachel by saying, Am I as God, who hath deprived thee of the fruit of thy womb? This one consideration should be sufficient to console married Christians. And meanwhile, I ask all who thus trouble themselves, do you think you have just cause for sorrow? You should rather rejoice, for in the first place, how many duties, cares, obligations, fears, and anxieties you escape, which fathers and mothers must suffer precisely because they have children. To say nothing of the inconvenience and discomfort they have to put up with day and night, while their children are still very young. What a great responsibility is theirs. If they do not bring up their children in a Christian manner, how great their trouble and anxiety if their children get sick, how deep their affliction if they die, how profound their grief if their children are deprived of their reason or suffer some other defect, and what a trial it is when they are disobedient, wicked, disrespectful, and obstinate. What care and labor it takes to feed and clothe them decently. See, from what God has freed you, you can enjoy your liberty and use your solitude in order the better to devote your time to the service of God and the salvation of souls. Is not that a great advantage? But perhaps you are wealthy and are very sorry that you have no heirs to whom you may leave your possessions. Why should that annoy you? If you wish, you can find heirs enough to whom it will be far better for you and more useful for your souls to leave your money. There are some birds that rear the young of other birds as if they were their own, as we know to be the case with hens that often rear ducklings. How many poor orphans there are who on the death of their parents are abandoned by every one. They have neither money, nor food, nor clothing. It is of them that Jesus Christ has said, "He that shall receive one such little child in my name, receiveth me." Take them into your house, then, or at least into your care. Provide for their want. They will certainly, in their gratitude, look upon you as their father and mother, and they will be to you as children, to replace those whom you anxiously ask from God. You can adopt as many of them as you wish, and in their persons you can feed and clothe Jesus Christ Himself. Do you wish for someone to inherit your property when you die? How many poor people there are here and there, and perhaps in your very neighborhood, you are in want and may, unknown to others, be without anything to eat, because they are ashamed to beg. They too represent the person of Jesus Christ. Make them your heirs. You will lose nothing by them, but will gain a great deal. They will make over your property to heaven, so that you will be able to live on it forever. And in that way, too, Jesus Christ will be your heir and your inheritance. Or act like that pious and noble couple in Rome who, after praying a long time fruitlessly for offspring, made the Blessed Virgin, the Queen of Heaven, their heiress, and daily besought her to make known to them how they should dispose of their wealth in her honor. Their request was so pleasing to the Mother of God that in the middle of summer she caused snow to fall miraculously in a certain place, as a sign that they should build a church there to her. They obeyed the sign and erected on the spot a magnificent temple which bears the name Maria ad Nevis to this day, and the feast of its consecration is celebrated every year on the 5th of August. From that you may see, merry Christians, that you have no reason to grieve, but rather much reason to rejoice if God leaves you childless. Just as they who have no children bewail their lot, so also they who have numerous offspring groan under the burden and complain that they have neither time nor means to bring them up properly. But even you, if you think of the matter sensibly, have more cause for consolation than for sorrow. For with regard to the annoyance and want of time of which you complain, tell me, are you badly off, after all? There is a shopkeeper who must spend the whole day at his business. He is hardly out of bed in the early morning when he hears people knocking at the door who want to buy something. While he is attending to them, others come. And so it goes on from morning to night. Customers are constantly coming in. One wants this, another that. His house is always full of people, that he hardly has time enough to take his meals, and in the evening he is not able to stand for weariness. What do you think of his case? It is truly very hard for the poor man to bear it. But did you ever hear a shopkeeper complain that too many customers come to him? I should think not, for on that his business depends. The more customers he has, the better pleased he is. And although they give him trouble, he is always glad to see them. He looks upon the trouble as nothing, provided he can make more money by it. Christian married people, what is the end and aim of the married state? I have told you already. The principal reason why you have chosen that state is to bring up children in the service of God. That is your principal duty, by performing which you will render a most pleasing service to God and will save your souls. That is your chief business, by which you can gain great glory in heaven for yourselves and children. So that, if you have many children, you are to be afflicted therefore. Certainly the annoyances, difficulties, and cares of your state will be increased. One child is crying out for something here, another there. One wants this, another that, etc. And the parents often do not know which they are to attend to first. But it is these very trials that your business consists. The more souls you can bring to heaven, the greater your gain and merit for eternity. And therefore you should rejoice at the good opportunity you have in your numerous offspring. But you think, it is easy to talk. If there are many children, they will require a good deal of food and clothing. And where is it to come from? Be satisfied. God, who sends you many to be fed, will also send you food for them, if you manage matters properly. Bring up your children as well as you can, some for a profession, others for an honorable trade or business. Let none of them be idle. Where there are many to work, there are many to earn. Only serve God, and put your confidence in Him as your Heavenly Father, as I have often told you. And He who fed the 5,000 with a few loaves of bread will not allow you or your children to suffer want, if you are only true to Him. The number of your children is also a help to you in this respect, and an incitement to serve God better. If you had only a few, you would, in all probability, lead an idle, luxurious, and therefore unchristian life. You would spend a considerable sum in dress and in eating and drinking. You would be fond of going out, and so might perhaps bring your children into sin and vice, and thus lead them to hell. But now, since you have a numerous offspring, all these things are impossible for you. The days seem too short for you, and you find working up in your own house, so that you have not to seek pastime elsewhere. You all pray together every day, and send up your petitions to heaven for temporal and spiritual prosperity. Rejoice, therefore, and be glad in the Lord. The third and last class of married people who trouble themselves without cause consists of those whose children die young. If the tree puts forth many blossoms, if the vine promises to bear well, we are more grieved when a frost or a hailstorm puts an end to our hope than if we never had any reason to hope, such as would be the case if the fruit tree or the vine perished in midwinter. Such is also the case with parents. They bewail their misfortune if their children die in the bloom of youth, just at the time when they promised to be a support and comfort to their parents for many years to come, far more than if they had no children at all. Alas, so I seem to hear them, especially the mother, sigh and lament. My only son, what a charming child he was, and now he is dead. My poor little daughter, I loved her most of all my children, and now she is dead, and all my consolation is gone with her. I am almost inclined to despair when I think of it. I shall not forget her as long as I live. Oh, what a trial, what a cross, what misery and affliction. Oh, poor afflicted people, certainly the hand of God lies heavily upon you. Could there be a greater sorrow upon earth? No, it is impossible that there could be. Weep, therefore, and bewail your misery as much as you please. But if I were looking at you, instead of pitying you, I should be inclined to laugh. Or if I had to show pity outwardly, it would be not for your sorrow, but for your folly. Do you think you have cause to afflict yourself so excessively? Excessively, I say, because it is natural, and no parent is to be blamed for it. It is natural to be sorrow for the death of a child. But I ask you again, have you any occasion for such excessive sorrow? In truth, if ever there was occasion for consolation and joy, it is this. For in addition to all the advantages which they have, as we said before, who are without children, they who have a child in heaven have a consolation and joy that others are without. And must I ask you why you brought into the world that child whose death you deplore? Was it that it might live a long life here below? No, certainly, that would not be enough. Its only end was heaven, its eternal country, and your duty, strictly defined for you by the Almighty God, was to lead it there by every means in your power. And you have attained your object. Your dear child is where it ought to be, and where you were bound to lead it, and yet you are so overwhelmed with sorrow. Tell me, if your son or daughter was grown up and had to take a long journey to a far-off city by a long and dangerous road, on which you know by experience that many have met with accident, riding or driving, and many have been attacked and killed by robbers, what anxiety would you not be until you heard that your beloved child has arrived in safety? Suppose now that your son had met with an unexpected piece of good luck on the way, that he had been taken up in a coach and had been able to finish his journey a week sooner than you expected. How would you act in hearing that news? Would you weep and lament? Would you tear your hair and cry out, "Alas, my son has arrived at his journey's end a week sooner than I thought. Why did he not go on foot?" Do you think you would act in that manner? Certainly not. It is only fools who would do so. No, your joy would be all the greater because your son arrived so quickly and accomplished his dangerous journey in safety. Now, with regard to your child's early death, remember this. As long as we mortals are on earth, we are on a journey. The city to which we are tending is the heavenly Jerusalem. The way leading thither in this valley of tears, in which we are exposed to all sorts of accidents that threaten the body, such as sickness, weakness, cares, trials, and difficulties, and in which there are still worse and more numerous dangers and temptations surrounding our souls on all sides and exposing us to eternal perdition. The greater number of travelers perish on the way and are dragged down to everlasting fire by the demons, the robbers of souls. Should we not then desire a happy termination to such a dangerous journey? Should we not rejoice when we hear that one whom we love has reached the heavenly city? Christian parents, your dear son or daughter was also on that journey. Who knows what would have happened to your child if it had spent many more years here below? Who knows whether it would have reached Jerusalem or have been dragged off to Babylon by the infernal spirit? The good God has, in his mercy, by special favor, taken it up in his chariot, so to speak, and brought it quickly to the end of its journey. And perhaps he has done so because he foresaw that you, in your excessive fondness, would rear up your child badly and cause a loss of its soul. As it is, your beloved one is safe and has escaped all dangers and troubles of soul and body, for you may be certain now that you could not be otherwise, that your child, dying in its baptismal innocence, is rejoicing with God in heaven, and consequently, that you have an intercessor there to whom you may pray in private. Do you weep and lament at hearing news like that? Where is your common sense, if so? You should rather thank the divine mercy, rejoice at your child's good fortune, and say with St. Francis Borgia, when he heard that his daughter was dead, "The Lord lent her to me, and he has taken her back again, and I know now that she is in his hands." Certainly, and my conclusion will be to you in the words of the wise Ecclesiasticus, already quoted, "Give not up thy soul to sadness, and afflict not thyself in thy own counsel." Merry Christians, make no sorrow for yourselves, the sorrow for past sins alone excepted, which is not helpful to the service of God. Do not torment yourself by your own fancies where you have no reason to be troubled, much less when you have rather reason to rejoice. The married state brings cares and troubles enough with it. Do not make unnecessary cares for yourselves. If you have nothing else to suffer, think that by your unreasonable cares you may force the Almighty to send you some of the real crosses and trials that others have to bear, and then you will have cause enough to mourn and lament. If you are like a little child that sits crying at the door until its mother runs out and asks, "What is the matter with you? Who has done anything to you?" But the child continues to cry until the mother gets vexed and, at last, takes the rod and gives the child a good beating, saying to it, "There, now you have something to cry for." I tell you, therefore, to be careful that God does not act with you in the same way. And now, do well and rejoice, and as St. Paul says, "Rejoice in the Lord always, in a good conscience, and in a virtuous and Christian life, which will bring you safely from this life to eternal joy." Amen.